Today's discussion will touch on where Wales stands on our net zero journey, how we compare to other nations, and how we can accelerate our transition and adaptation to the climate emergency. Wales has been considered to be at the forefront of policy development on climate, not least in the establishment of the Wellbeing of Future Generations Act itself, but also in the establishment of new air quality legislation and ambitious, if politically contentious, transport policies. Yet we're seeing very varying degrees of success in policy implementation and delivery. In Wales, we've been good at diagnosing the problems and the challenges we face when it comes to net zero. We're also good at setting ambitious targets and articulating the case for change, not always broadly, but at that high level. But Team Wales as a whole is much less effective at delivering on these pledges. And so in this critical decade for climate action on a national and global scale, Wales has no choice but to deliver on these commitments. Today's discussion will look to establish where the climate governance arrangements are working, how we can deliver transformative change within devolved structures, and much more. A little bit of housekeeping before we go. I've had the fire alarm. Hopefully you won't have it. We've always encouraged you to introduce yourselves and engage with each other in the chat. We've got over 100 people in the room at the moment. Do please say hello. Share your emails if you want to. We're particularly happy to have lots of our members joining, but also some new faces. We've got people from universities, from Nesta, from Renewable UK Cymru, from Citizens Advice, Welsh Government, the Senedd, UK Government, and many more. Please send your questions by the Q&A function on Zoom at the bottom of your screens. We've got a bit longer than normal for our discussion, and we'll have over half an hour for questions at the end. So get thinking about your questions now. Please remember, everybody, that I always take the first question from a woman, as the evidence says that more women then ask questions subsequently, and I'm certainly not going to change that now. Remember also that the event, as well as all chat and questions, are recorded. The event is an hour and a half, so we're finishing at 11:30. And if you want to tweet, you can at us at @IWA_Wales, and we suggest using #IWANetZero as the hashtag. Video and audio of today's event will be made available via our YouTube and podcast channels. Okay, housekeeping done. I'm now going to kick us off by introducing our guest speakers today. Chris Stark has been Chief Executive Officer of the Climate Change Committee since April 2018. His previous role was Director of Energy and Climate Change in the Scottish Government, leading the development of Scotland's approach to emissions reduction and the accompanying energy system transition. Chris has got wide experience of economic policy making in the Scottish Government, in the Treasury, and the Department for Business, Innovation and Skills. Chris is leaving his role later in the year to become the CEO of the Carbon Trust, congratulations, where he'll continue to use his platform for accelerating the UK's net zero journey, no doubt. Welcome, Chris.
Thanks, Sori. It was lovely to be here.
Derek Walker is the Future Generations Commissioner for Wales. He was previously Chief Exec of Cwmpas, the UK's largest cooperative development agency, where he worked to support people and communities to create jobs and strengthen communities and change the organisation's focus to sustainable development. Derek's also worked as Head of External Affairs at the Big Lottery Fund Wales, Head of Policy and Campaigns at the Wales TUC, and was the first employee of Stonewall Cymru. Croeso, Derek.
Thank you, Diolch.
Great. So we've got to about 11 o'clock, give or take, for our conversation. I'm conscious that we've got lots of technical experts in the room, but we're also going to have lots of generalists. So I'm going to ask you both to explain things and set things out as clearly and accessibly as you can. So let's break things down nice and clearly. So Chris, for those in the room who don't yet know, can you summarise what the UK CCC is and the context of its work in Wales, please?
Of course, thank you. And it's a good place to start, I think. So I'm going to rewind slightly and answer the question in a slightly longer way. So you need to go back to quite an interesting period in British politics, and I say British deliberately here, towards the end of the noughties. So you might remember around that time, those of you who've been around and looked at climate change over that time, we were producing in this country some of the most important analysis of the economics of climate change at that time, in particular, Nick Stern, who's a very prominent figure in this field, produced an amazing report. Actually, at the time, while I was working at the UK Treasury, I didn't work on climate at the time, but it was astonishing the impact that it had globally. And it was a very global piece of work. it led then to calls that we should have some sort of domestic legislation over climate change. And that itself was quite a controversial thing at the time, because, of course, climate change is a global issue. But the UK sort of pioneered a piece of legislation that led the domestic challenge of how we address climate change, and in particular set out that the UK as a whole had to reduce greenhouse gas emissions over a number of decades. And it was quite an interesting piece of legislation in all sorts of ways, because it also pioneered a different institutional approach to this. So the idea of reducing emissions is something that has to happen over several decades, if you want it to be sustainable, at least. And of course, the Act then recognised that governments are not that good at steering things over multiple decades. So it gave this long-term goal and created the idea that there should be interim targets for cutting emissions over that period every 5 years, and that there should be some sort of independent institution that looked across all of that and gave advice on what to do about it. So that was us looking UK-wide with a duty to Welsh ministers. So one of the other features of that Act is that it very much had devolution built into it from the off. So my appointment, for example, when my replacement comes along, will be signed off by Welsh ministers. Roll forward a few years, and Wales has its own legislation now to actually tackle climate change. And I'm sure Derek will talk about another piece of legislation that governs how it tackles climate change. And we work under that framework now too. And broadly, it's similar to the UK. It's that every 5 years, there's an obligation on whatever the flavour of government we have in Wales to bring about the measures necessary to cut emissions on a path towards the long-term goal. And the last part of this story is that we've been talking already about net zero in this discussion. And net zero is the target for the long future, I suppose you could say, but it's not that long now. So 2050 is the point by which we have to reach net zero. That's a very important target. I'm sure we'll talk more about that, but that is actually a new target. So in my time in this job over the last 6 years, we've raised the ambition to cut emissions by what used to be 80% by 2050 to a 100% target. That's what net zero really means, by 2050, which requires therefore a different path. So one of the jobs I do at the moment is give advice on what's in that path for Wales and for the UK. And we try and hold those two things together. I also do that job for Northern Ireland and for Scotland. And then periodically, we give advice on whether Welsh ministers and UK ministers are doing the job they will need to do to bring that path about to hit those legal targets. And if you've ever heard me speak, you probably know that my view of that is that we are not achieving that at the moment. So that's a really interesting thing to discuss later, I think, Orion.
I'm going to get into that in lots more detail. Thank you. It's useful to have that sort of genesis for people as well. Derek, tell us more about the role of the Future Generations Commissioner for Wales. What does it entail? What do you do, and what do you want to achieve while you're in post? You've got 6 years to go nearly, haven't you? Just over 6 years,
yes. Well, the role was set up by the Wellbeing of Future Generations Act, which came into being back in 2016. And this is bold, it's imperfect, but it's a progressive legislation to guide the direction of our country over the years to come. So it sets out an ambition for our country with 7 well-being goals, and it sets out 5 ways of working for how we should work to achieve those well-being goals. We have 50 measures or indicators of success and 17 milestones that tell us as a country how well we're doing in meeting that agenda. So it's the latest stage in Wales's commitment to sustainable development and understanding how we approach sustainable development. It applies as legislation primarily to the public sector and to the devolved public sector. And there will be over 50 public sector bodies coming with new bodies being added this year under the Act by the end of this year. So, but what we do see, and what is, you know, what has been a real pleasant surprise to me, I guess, is how much interest there is beyond the public sector. So because of devolution, the legislation only applies to the public sector, but there's lots of support and interest and commitment to delivering on this agenda within the voluntary sectors and within the private sectors too. And I always think of this legislation as people's legislation, because it was led by Jane Davidson, Peter Davis, and many other people that made this happen. But also, this is embedded in, you know, the exercise of a national conversation called The Wales We Want. There was lots of civil society engagement in deciding what this legislation might look like and trying to put it together. So it has, it's embedded, I think, across Wales's society. And I think that's important for the foundations of this legislation. You asked, Oriel, about what, you know, I want to achieve, and perhaps I can come back to some of this later on in the conversation. And, you know, I put together a strategy which was launched in November called Cymru Can. And in some ways, putting together Cymru Can was made easier by the fact that we were getting consistent messages from people about what they felt about the Wellbeing of Future Generations Act and my role in delivering it. And I think someone described it as a difficult second album, my role as the commissioner. And we're in a phase now. The processes have been set up. There's a widespread awareness, I think, about the legislation, but we need to focus on the implementation gap. So there's been great things achieved, but we need to see more of that achieved and supporting the public bodies in particular to deliver on their ambitions, you know, in particular and including on climate change and carbon emissions. So, and my role, very briefly, is as the independent commissioner. So it's important that this role is independent of government, appointed by Welsh government, but independent of government in the same way as the Children's Commissioner is and the Older Persons Commissioner. And formally, the role is about advice. So supporting public bodies to deliver on this agenda, monitoring their progress and undertaking reviews where I want to do some in-depth work, usually often where we're not satisfied with progress, and we want to understand what's going on and make recommendations about how that can be improved. But it has a wider role, I think, in convening people together to understand how we work together to get things done, in identifying solutions and in highlighting areas of good and bad practice. So it's an important part of the Wellbeing of Future Generations Act, but it's just one part of it. And, you know, it's for all of us to deliver on this agenda.
Okay, thank you. We talk a lot at the IWO about policy levers. So let's sort of look at how things change. So we've got this intention, we've got the act, we've got the targets. It's a question really for both of you. Chris, I'll come to you first. The policy levers for Wales to meet its net zero obligations sit across both those devolved powers, devolved to Wales, and the reserve powers to Westminster. How do you think this intersection is being managed? You know, are governments across the UK working together to the required extent? I know, for instance, from having been a member, and I'm still actually a member of the expert panel for the Constitutional Commission that produced its final report last week, that its commissioners have very clear views on this in relation to energy, for instance, and we provided some of that background. What are your views?
Well, I mean, my views are very much coloured not just by the job I do now, but the one I did before it. So I was in charge of the bit of the Scottish government that dealt with energy and climate before I did this job. So I've worked on energy policy and climate policy in the UK in some shape or form now for 13 years. And my view generally is that we don't make enough of the very rich links that there should be between the UK government and any of the devolved governments, and in this case, the Welsh government. And in fact, what you have instead is much more of an oppositional discussion, which is very, very wasteful. And I definitely see that in this place. You know, I think when we look at what Wales is doing, there are, of course, a mixture of policy levers available to us to decarbonise Wales, and indeed to get it ready for the change in the climate that's coming. There isn't really any area of policy that you could say is all UK or all Welsh, although that is often the way that it is framed. And actually, every single area of policy has some mixture of things going on. So I suppose my answer to your question is definitely we're not doing enough there, and there definitely isn't enough interaction between the UK government and the Welsh government. Politics, I suppose, makes some of that hard, but there aren't even the right forums, I think, to have the right discussions. So I think that's kind of one really important thing here. But secondly, I would say that neither party, the UK government or the Welsh government, is as creative as they could be about exploiting these links, I would say. And I take that very much from my own experience. So in Scotland, for example, when we were making energy policy, conventionally you say energy policy is a reserved matter. That means it's all for UK ministers. But of course, that's not true. You know, planning powers matter. The consent of the people living in that country is a real thing, even if the powers aren't there. And a lot of the levers, to use that term, Oriel, in devolved government and indeed at local government at a different level, tend to be at the, you know, not the supply end, but the demand end, if you can think of it that way. So the things that you can do to change the, you know, the demand for things, you can think about really simple things like, you know, the provision of parking, for example. That has a really important implication for the transport decarbonisation trajectory. So there isn't really any of these policies that sits definitely in one place or the other. But definitely, we're not making good policy at the moment that is driving us towards the legal goals either at UK level or Welsh level.
So we're going to pick up on this a bit more. I mean, the other thing, Derek, we've increasingly done at the RWA is talk much more about powers and money, because Chris's point is you know, we've got different layers of government, and the supply and demand issues within at each level, but there's also where the money lies. So your role is focused on holding Welsh government to account, isn't it? But to what extent can Wales dictate its own net zero ambitions when powers and money are so diffused?
Well, there's a lot in our own control, and I don't think we should take the fact that we don't have all the money and all the levers as an excuse for not being able to do things. Of course, that's a given. I think we would all agree with that. But sometimes it is used in that way, I think, and we need to avoid doing that. But that's not to say the situation couldn't be better. And I really agree with Chris's point. And also, you know, I come back to the point you were making about the Constitutional Commission work and that you've been involved with, Oriel. I have personal views about devolution and independence, but in some ways, when I come to this job, that doesn't matter. What matters to me is what's getting in the way of delivering on our objectives of the Wellbeing of Future Generations Act, and does the current settlement get in the way? And I think the Constitutional Commission report, which I'm wading my way through, which is a really well-written report, and I'd encourage others to read it, gives us some of these answers. What it tells us is, in the area of rail, for example, it clearly says this current arrangements are getting in the way of modal shift, and they're complex. And as a result of the complexity, this is adding expense to the arrangements, which could be spent elsewhere. In the area of energy, it comes back to Chris's point, really. You know, we need to look at how things are working and review current arrangements. And I think, you know, one of the messages from the report is it's not always about where the funding lies or the policy levers lie, but it's about having those balanced arrangements, those intergovernment arrangements that put Welsh government on the same basis as the UK government, on a basis of parity, to have those conversations about how they can work together to deliver on this agenda. And at the moment, we can see that isn't happening to the extent that we need it to do, both in the area that we're talking about now, but we could see that, couldn't we, during the COVID situation, and we're seeing the same during the Tata situation. So it's an urgent area of concern that we have to get these intergovernmental relationships right, and we need to look at where powers and funding lies, not for the sake of it, but because we have important objectives to deliver and the current arrangements are getting in the way.
Yeah. Okay. So we've got a year of change ahead of us now. In Wales, it's like, you know, Christmas coming multiple times in the next 3 years, because we've got so many elections coming up. But before we get to that, Rishi Sunak, Derek, has veered into equivocation on some of the net zero commitments and timescales, most notably on the pushback on the date to ban the sale of new petrol and diesel cars. Wales has had a much more consistent message, but is it getting through clearly enough? I mean, we held a round table on transport yesterday on how we might need, one of the things that came up was how we might need to take much more of a marketing approach. If you look at the money that goes into marketing new cars, for instance, how are we as policy people and others involved in Team Wales in delivery as well, how are we communicating the intent that we have to decarbonize? And does that need to shift up a gear? Forgive the analogy.
Yes, it needs to shift up a gear. And I think, yes, we are struggling at the moment. I think, you know, it's not helpful, is it, that people are getting mixed messages from the UK government and different messages from the UK government in terms of supporting the motorist and language around that, which, you know, no one's against supporting motoring, but we are looking also about transitioning and modal shift and supporting more people to use public transport and to do active travel. So if the signals are different from both, you know, from different governments, then that's bound to get in the way and confuse businesses and third sector organisations, but also the people as a whole about, you know, what we're meant to be doing and when we do it. And it causes hesitation, uncertainty causes hesitation around action. We know that to be the case. So I think it is getting in the way. I guess we're not helped. You know, this is going back to the Commission's report, Oriel, which you know better than I do. You know, it said points about broadcasting, didn't it? And about, you know, the fact that a lot of us in Wales get most of our news from the UK level or from the UK press, and that often doesn't cover Wales accurately or at all, and people might get you know, messages around English policy or English programs and activities and not Welsh ones. So all of this creates a complex picture. And you know what I would say on this, and I'll probably say it again at some point, is, you know, this is about involving people and taking people on the journey with us, isn't it? You know, the Wellbeing of Future Generations Act, I think one of the most powerful things within the Act is the ways of working. And one of the ways of working is involvement. And when you involve people in these decisions and communicate clearly, you know, why we're taking these decisions and what they're for, you're more likely to bring people with you. And we have some big changes ahead, don't we? Not just in terms of carbon emissions, but more generally in terms of the things that we need to do to protect our environment, to protect our nature. And we need to, you know, work with people to make those changes happen. And you know, I certainly think, you know, there are lessons to learn from how we're doing that at the moment.
I think we're going to come back to the point of involvement. And yeah, you're absolutely right. There's a reason why the IWRA has been looking at media policy for the last decade and a half, because how you understand the world around you, where decisions are made and who you hold to account for them, for the delivery of those decisions, makes a difference in terms of how you can exercise your own democratic rights as citizens and engage at whatever level you wish to engage. Thank you. Let's come back to that. Chris, I'd like you to spend a little bit of time, please, setting out the scale of the delivery gap. We've been talking about delivery for a number of years, ever since, you know, you look behind me on re-energising Wales, how we get to renewables by, you know, 2035, 100% renewables by 2035. We're delighted Welsh Government's finally accepted the scale of our ambition. But, you know, we know that the issue is delivery, delivery, delivery. Tell us more, please, in detail about the scale of the delivery gap.
Well, this could be a very long session. I'll try and not make it a long one, but it's, I might just go back to something that Derek reflected on, actually, which is the Prime Minister's speech of last year, because it sort of set the context for that delivery gap, actually. And it's quite an interesting speech to look at if you work on climate. It will not surprise many in the audience that I took a pretty dim view of some of the things that he said in that speech, which I'm statutorily required to take. So in that speech, the Prime Minister said that he was firmly committed to net zero, and indeed committed to where he would like the country to be by 2030 under the pledge that we put to the UN process. Those two targets are very ambitious, and Welsh targets are aligned with those two targets. So that sort of sets the frame for what needs to be done. But I think what the Prime Minister also did was this thing about mixed messages. Mm. He gave the impression that he wished to go slower on net zero whilst maintaining those targets, which is a slightly difficult thing to have in your head, sort of cognitive dissonance. And that, for me, is the biggest challenge, actually. You're right to pull out the electric vehicles date. He moved the UK-wide date by which We had planned to stop the sale of petrol and diesel cars and vans. We had one of the most ambitious dates in the world of 2030, and he moved that back to 2035. That doesn't actually have that much of an impact on emissions, but it creates an enormous signal to a collection of people who might be thinking about an electric car as their next car, or the people who drive cars, company cars, those sorts of things. So that sort of signal is very important. What's happened since is the point I was kind of angling towards. Quite interesting, although he made that speech and has since backed it up with several other speeches talking about his different approach to net zero, actually there's been a ton of very good climate policy that's come after that, including one on electric vehicles. So there's a mandate on the manufacturers of electric cars, of cars, to produce a greater proportion of electric cars, which he hasn't changed despite changing that date. So we've got this kind of strange situation where we've got lots of climate policy coming through after that speech, but we have a government in Westminster, at least, that doesn't want to talk about it. And it's I've been calling that recently green hushing. It's a very strange thing, actually. I've not really seen this ever happen before. So we do all this big policy, but we don't want anyone to talk about it. So I think messages really matter here, which is a sort of... Sorry, Oriel, you're going to ask a question. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, is he just playing to the gallery, though?
Well, I suspect he is. And here I might, I'll step out of my formal statutory role and say it does look that way to me. Yes, it looks like his constituency on the right wing of particularly his own party doesn't want to hear about green policies, and yet he's still got a government that wants to produce them. So there's a tension there, no doubt. Here we come to the delivery question then. So let's step away from UK politics, yeah, which is a good thing to do in all situations, I find, at the moment. So into the Welsh sphere, we have in Wales an enormous challenge before us of decarbonising a country the size of Wales. It is not just about what we do with our energy systems, although that is one of the core parts of it. But we've also got a challenge to not just decarbonize that economy, but also to move society with it. So I think the biggest delivery challenge is that we haven't in Wales, I'm afraid, framed up what that looks like, I would say, in as much detail as we should have. And one of the key questions for me is, can we move more quickly towards actually putting some colour around what that future looks like for net zero in Wales? The technical question of the delivery gap is that we have a set of sectors where you will find the emissions produced in Wales, and we are not moving in Wales as fast to decarbonise them as we are in other parts of the UK. And UK-wide, we think that UK is moving too slowly too. So there's a gap in decarbonising buildings. That is a key issue for, a social issue, actually, more than an economic one. That's about making those buildings more energy efficient, having better fabric in those buildings, which also means better living conditions in those buildings, as well as bringing low carbon heat to those buildings. We have a challenge with decarbonising the Welsh energy sector, in particular how we generate electricity. And of course, there's UK policy in play there. We had better at some point in this discussion this morning talk about Welsh industry. That is one of the biggest challenges of all. And of course, some big steps there, which is a very clear example of UK policy and Welsh policy having to operate in cooperation. But again, slow progress there. And then you could go on. Transport's the next one. Some promising signs, perhaps, of transport systems moving more quickly in Wales. And then the other big one, I would say, is agriculture and land. So here you've got actually mostly policies that sit with the Welsh Senate. And the need to create a new environment in which farming and agriculture and the change of use in land that we will see and should try to steer is mostly sitting in Welsh politics and the gift of Welsh ministers to change, and yet not much happening there either when it comes to climate. So there's lots that you could say is happening, but it's just not at the required pace if you think those targets mean anything. And I think for me, that's the biggest delivery gap of all. It's a gap in ambition and creativity to deliver those targets, which could be profoundly positive for Wales if they're pulled off, I think.
And we've got to make much more progress, haven't we? The second carbon budget says we've got to make much more progress in the next decade than we have in the last 30.
That's correct. An
average reduction of 37%.
Yeah, we've got this very briefly. We have a carbon budget process at UK level, but also now at Welsh level. And the first carbon budget period was from 2016 to 2020 in Wales. And that target was met pretty comfortably. But that target was set in a different time with a different long-term goal. And the carbon budgets to follow, carbon budgets two and three and onwards, will be much, much more challenging. And for those targets, we see that the Welsh government, in combination with UK policymakers, are not on target to hit those targets, but in fact, quite substantially off track.
And pre-cost of living, pre the war in Ukraine, pre what's going on in Israel and Palestine at the moment.
That's right. Although there's the edge to that is that it's what Putin has done in Ukraine is, of course, you know, weaponized in a sense the cost of fossil fuels. You know, he's quite deliberately, you know, as a policy, decided to make the West pay more for fossil fuels. My own belief is that damaging as that is, that's turbocharged the decarbonisation story too. And you saw some of that at global level definitely playing out in Dubai. So the challenge for policymakers in this country now is a different one, actually. I think it's the very obvious incentive to get off this stuff because it's a very expensive cost and it's a very clear source of insecurity to something that is decarbonised and domestic and clean and cheap. That sort of movement actually has been, it's much more obvious that we should make that move. But the challenge for policymakers is, of course, that we have to protect people over that transition so that they're not required to burn, you know, bear the cost of something they can't afford. And I think, to be honest with you, that's probably always been the challenge, but it's just that what Vladimir Putin has done is expose that more clearly.
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to ask the team to put your progress report for Wales in the chat so that people who haven't seen it can see the technical detail behind this too. Derek, let's turn to you. So in your Future Gens role, you've made a very clear pitch to focus on the implementation of the Act in your new strategy, Cymru Can. You've talked about 50 new public bodies joining. That's in addition to the what? How many who are bound
eight
by the
new
Act?
Eight new joining, which will make over 50. No, there's not 50 new.
I was going to say, whoa, that's quite a big. I was just checking that. Thank you for clarifying. Yeah. Can you talk us through how your work and the team's work is therefore shifting to engender that transformation in the way public bodies work? And I want to hear a little bit about what you're planning to do with private sector organisations, because I think one of the clear messages that came out of our conversation, and obviously it's not, you know, it's not the only place that this is coming from. We've talked about it a little bit today already, is the need for confidence for the private sector in terms of where they're going to put their money. It's not only about public money, is it? Yes, there's money in the system and it can be better spent. That's one of our themes at the IWA. Things like calling for pension funds to be divested from fossil fuels and invested into things that will generate ownership and wealth creation in Wales, and community ownership too, obviously. But talk us through how you're shifting how the Commission's office works, to engender that transformation, please.
Yeah, there's a lot there and a few points I wanted to make. Auriel, at one point, I think it would be good to refer to or perhaps bring in someone from the Net Zero 2035 group, because their work is, you know, demonstrating how Wales is wanting to be ambitious in this area. And, you know, they're looking at practical pathways to deliver on net zero by 2035. Yeah. So it will be interesting to hear from them about, you know, how that work is going, because full credit, they're doing a lot of good work as part of that group. One of the ways, and I say this while Chris is here, you know, Chris and I had a good conversation a few months back. And I think one of the ways that I will want him to be shifting my work, or one of the ways I can see real partnership, is with organisations like the UK Climate Change Committee, because the report that you've just asked to be put in the chat, Auriel, is very clear about what Welsh Government needs to be cracking on with in terms of making the progress we need to see. And, you know, it talks about speeding up the pace of EV infrastructure. It talks about peatland and tree planting, peatland restoration, protection, tree planting as being areas where we're falling behind. And this, you know, this takes us on to the sustainable farming scheme that Welsh Government is consulting on at the moment. But why I mention that is because I think there's a key role for my office in sort of working with Chris and his team and Chris's successor in his team in keeping and, you know, making sure that those recommendations are then taken forward and acted on, because Chris's team has got huge amounts of technical expertise, which we don't have in my team. But what we can do is amplify those messages and keep reminding Welsh Government and public bodies of the recommendations in this report and be monitoring that progress. Just to talk about, the wider role, what this means for me is providing, much more practical hands-on support for the delivery. So, and a bit more scrutiny about, some of the progress that we're making. So one of the things that the report that Chris's team published in June about Wales, it looked at local authority carbon action plans gave us and looked at the scorecard that had been done by Climate Emergency UK, I think, to see how these plans were in terms of their quality. And it didn't give us a very good feedback about the quality of those plans. And I think since then, a lot of work has been done and is being done by WLGA and others to improve those plans. But I think, it's clear that my office has a role in eyes on that, making sure that the plans that we've got in place are good quality, they're ambitious, and then monitoring their implementation. So it's difficult for some others, I guess, in the public space to be saying the things, certain things, and being critical, especially if they're involved in having to deliver on them. But my job as an independent commissioner is to be holding, pointing out where we're not delivering and looking more closely at some of that.
And
can I just say one more thing, Laura? Yes, just, the other thing, and I'd love feedback from the audience, the other ways is thinking about practical examples. And I think clearly what's come through is for me, is one way in which we can support public bodies, perhaps around the delivery of carbon action plans, is by looking at the Race to Zero framework as a way in which we can encourage local authorities not just to deliver on their own ambitions, but take a lead territorial and be part of a common framework where you can access advice and support. And I think that perhaps illustrates one practical way in which we can provide support and be alongside public bodies in the challenge in the financial challenges in which they face.
So I don't think lots of people will necessarily know about Race to Zero net yet. That's a UN-wide exercise, isn't it, and challenge that local authorities and other bodies can sign up to. Is that correct?
I'm not sure if it's UN-led, but Chris might know better than I do. It's certainly a global initiative with a common frame. Sorry, Chris.
No, you're right. You're absolutely right. That's right, Derek.
Yeah. So it's a global initiative, which... regions and councils and cities around the world are looking to take forward. And I think I think the key bits for me about why we might take forward a Race to Zero approach within Wales is because we can learn globally. We can look at comparing our progress to others, but also it's this point about a territorial approach. So, local authorities have a commitment around their own emissions, but we want them to lead the society, the civil society, the private businesses within their area too. And it's only through that collaboration and integration that we're going to make the progress we want to see.
And that matters, doesn't it? Because obviously culture eats strategy for breakfast in terms of how things land and how things then get implemented. You've talked a little bit about your role in holding to account, Derek. Can you talk a little bit about how things are working well and where the best examples of the Act making change happen can already be seen?
I think transport is a good example to cite here, Oriel. We've seen great leadership and ambition within Welsh Government about transport and a clear direction about the modal shift that we want to see and how we want to reduce our emissions in this space. And I think if it wasn't for the Wellbeing of Future Generations Act, we wouldn't be seeing this change. This has been fundamental to the different and bold approach that we're taking. So, without going through this in too much detail, I think the M4 Relief Road decision around Newport, which was, we decided against this, the First Minister decided against this. And, a lot of that decision was pointed to because it wasn't in line with the Wellbeing of Future Generations Act. So that's signalled a huge shift in our approach to transport policy. And so now we're seeing Something like, I think it was in the last Senate budgets, we were seeing a shift from 2/3 of our budget, transport budget, being spent on roads to 1/3, and the rest being spent on active travel and sustainable transport. We have seen the, well, what's being called the moratorium on road building, but, you know, there will be road building, but that's got to, one of the criteria is that that road building has to achieve modal shift. We've seen an increase in the active travel budget, and we've seen the 20 miles per hour policy, which I think is the right policy and will support modal shift. But we're in a transition period here, aren't we? You know, we all know that the public transport system in Wales, to say the least, is not where we need it to be. You know, we are investing in it, but it's not still attractive for many people to replace their car journeys. And if you look at, I was digging out some of the facts and figures around modal shift in Wales prior to this conversation, and they're, thanks to Sustrans for pointing them out, but they're hidden away on the Transport for Wales website. And what you can see is, you know, we haven't really seen a shift in people using public transport over the last decade yet. We did see, we have seen a dip in the number of kilometres driven by people, and we have seen a dip in emissions. Some of this is because of COVID, and some of this is now starting to rise. But I guess what I'm saying here is, you know, this is a work in progress. We've got to keep our eyes on the prize. The ambition that we have in Wales is the right one. We are taking some of the bold steps that we need to take to get to where we need to go. But we're not there yet, and let's keep at it. And, you know, I worry, you know, just going back to this point about taking people with us, you know, it's interesting to see both leadership candidates talk about a review of the 20 miles per hour implementation. We need to understand, you know, how to do things like that better, because we are going to have to make big significant changes, and we need to take people with us in creative ways.
Let's come on to that in a tick. One of the things around public transport, obviously, is the you know, urban rural divide as well, and how that's particularly important for a much more predominantly rural Wales, where people live in towns and communities across the country. It also leads us on, Chris, I'm going to come to you with some stuff around data and evidence, because we haven't had a transport survey in Wales since 2012, actually over a decade. And we'll have, I think we've got the intimations of one towards the end of this year, which will have, give us a where we are now. Great. Some of those changes obviously have happened, as Derek said, because of COVID. But part of your role is monitoring UK government, the three devolved nations governments, on the performance of their policies on net zero. And obviously you need to know where you are and how that progress is going. So to what extent do you think the measurement indices here in Wales are robust enough to give us an accurate picture? And then I wanted us to talk a little bit about adaptation too, please.
Yeah, of course. Well, I think we have invested quite a lot of time here in the CCC trying to understand what it actually means to have progress indicators. Now, I'd like to tell you a brief, another bit of history. I suppose I'm feeling very reflective. Perhaps it's because I'm leaving. But when this organization began in 2008, the key performance indicator was the emissions data. So we would have looked at emissions in each sector, and there's always a lag of a couple of years in that data. So we'd have been looking at that, saying, you know, how is it going in industry? How is it going in the power sector? How is it going in the transport sector? What we have now is something fundamentally different to that. So we have, you know, we're not looking back at all anymore. What we have now is a really clear sense of what we need to do across the economy to decarbonize it, and also to bring about that positive social change that Derek and I would like to see. And what that allows us to do is something pretty cool, actually, which is to say, look, emissions, of course, are important, but what drives emissions is a set of outcomes in each corner of the economy. And, you know, in turn, what drives those outcomes is a set of conditions that allow the outcomes to take place. And there's a much broader set of things happening in the world as well. Now, we can put indicators around all of those things. And actually, we can measure some of this stuff as weekly data. Actually, you can really get an eye on things happening much more quickly that way. So to take Derek's example, the transport sector, we collect every single month the data on the sales of electric cars, for example, and it tells you a lot because we have a pathway for what we expect to happen to hit the targets in the transport sector, which, albeit a very small numbers at the moment, shows you whether we're on track or not for that pathway in 2030 and 2040. It's a bit like during COVID. Remember, we were all addicted to looking at what was happening with the numbers, you know, that sort of, and small movements in numbers could tell you a lot about the future change. Most of the shifts that need to happen in Wales and across the UK and indeed right around the world involve exponential change. So you get this sort of rapid, over time, more and more rapid replacement of fossil fueled assets with something cleaner. And you can spot that basically in some of those key metrics. Now, when it comes to Wales, we haven't built the full sophisticated indicator framework that allows us to do that yet, but you can use a lot of the UK-wide stuff. So that's something that we have in the plan. So we're gonna develop that. It's a bit like a sort of logic model of the change and how it would take place across the economy. We'll have more of that over the course of the next 12 to 24 months for Wales in the work that my organisation produces. We'll also have a new one of those pathways. So we'll be developing a new pathway for the whole of the UK and for Wales specifically out to 2050. So that's quite exciting, and a lot of that information will be in there. That brings me then to the second part of your question, Oriel, because although cutting emissions is hugely important, and you know the one of the reasons why it's so interesting to look at emissions is because greenhouse gas emissions, or carbon, however you want to call it, they are in every part of society. So if you're trying to cut it, you need to think in a whole society way about it, which is why I think we've been so good at developing some of the key pathways that I talked about and understanding what their implication would be. What we've been less good at is, to me, probably the more important issue, which is understanding how climate change itself will impact on this country and the people living in it, and indeed other parts of the world. And sometimes that's called resilience, sometimes it's called climate risk. There is a very important a branch of the climate work called adaptation, which is about how we adapt ourselves to these changes in climate. My feeling is that is probably where we need to go next to develop more sophisticated tools. And we have to develop a better way of talking about it as well. So previous holders of this job would have said that these things are actually in opposition as well. You've got cutting emissions and adaptation are the two things, and we can't really talk about them together. Well, we need to do that. So we've got to talk about achieving net zero in a warming climate. And I'm afraid that's where we are going to be. Even if the world decarbonizes at lightning fast pace, most of the warming in the global warming that we'll see to 2050 is already baked in. So that means we should be better at planning for that. And that means that over the course of the next 2 to 3 decades, we have a really strong sense of what change in the climate is going to come to Wales. We have some of the best climate forecasting in the world in this country, thanks to the Met Office. So we should be better at planning for that, and yet we don't. So in particular, when we make plans for housing or for infrastructure, when we make plans even for agriculture, we're not planning in the change in the climate that you can very confidently predict. So I think that the next step for this is to talk about something. Listen, cutting emissions is a big challenge, but we've also got to think about how we cut emissions whilst adapting ourselves to, I'm afraid, the change in the climate that's coming. There are a tiny number of positives to that, very small number. The one I always fall back on is grapes. You might get more grapes grown in this country, but there's not much else to look forward to. So this is more about avoiding big risks that we know will impact on us, and actually making a virtue of the fact that a lot of this is extremely well predicted now, and yet strangely doesn't feature in the public discourse and doesn't feature often in some really important infrastructure planning that happens in this country either. So I find that really interesting. The last thing I'll say in this, though, is that we really lack the clarity about what to do on adaptation. So we don't have what we, you know, that very well articulated view. Thank you for putting the link to my report in the chat. You will see in that report the amount of detail that we're able to bring and technical expertise to the challenge of decarbonizing the Welsh economy. But we don't have that on adaptation. We don't have a sense of what needs to be done in each part of society or each sector of the economy. That, for me, is the next bit of this. So, you know, again, in the CCC, I know we're going to try and put some numbers around that. But actually, that is really exciting, actually, to think about that and think about that. What, can we build the same sort of idea of a pathway ahead to something better?
Thanks. It's a moment of cognitive dissonance there too, isn't it, Chris, in relation to you know, we talk lots about how the certainties of the last few years have just been taken away from under our feet, and not just because of COVID, because of all sorts of other things that have happened, and how difficult it is to forecast what might happen in future, not just politically, but also politically. And yet, this is certain. We know this is going to happen. Yeah. There has been quite a lot of work. One of the things that did provide cut through, I think, in terms of Wales was the forecasting on how which bits of coastal Wales would be underwater by 2050. Well, what does that mean for people's homes, businesses, communities, schools? What does that mean for insurers? What does that mean for private business? All those sorts of things. But it's kind of there. Oh, God, what am I going to do about it?
Well, I think one of the challenges, Oriel, and I know you'll get this, I'm certain Derek will too, and I'm pretty sure the audience for this will too, but the sad thing with climate change is it's climate change is, of course, an issue, but it's symptomatic of what we're doing, basically. It's right. It's a sort of clear, it's a clear symptom of the problem more generally, what we're, you know, the way that we're running a society globally. But one of the impacts of climate change is that however you look at this, however much you throw at it, however much money you put into flood defences and building walls and sea defences, pretty much across the board, it is likely to be worse in the future than it is today. And that's a very difficult message, actually. So if you think about flooding, which is probably the most important of the climate impacts in this country, we've had another experience of flooding in the UK and indeed Wales in the last few weeks. Flooding in the future is likely to be worse. And that is a very difficult message. And that even at that, that's even if you throw everything at it. So that's one of the reasons why I think we haven't done what you've described, which is to plan ahead properly, is because we often look to politicians and politics to determine that. And it's never a good message to say, look, there's nothing I can do about this to make it better. It will only be, at best, be slightly worse. But I think it's really important that we have institutions that are able to say something like that, but also put in a more positive framing. Look, we have a sense of what can be done here, and it will be a better outcome for the country if we start to plan ahead for that now. And that's basically what I think we in the CCC should be doing more of, actually, is pointing out some of the difficult messages, but then presenting a more positive idea of what to do to tackle them, not just diagnosing the problem, but actually bringing real solutions to it. We've done that much better on net zero than we have on the challenge of resilience to climate change or adaptation.
And that's a particularly hard thing to hear in this week, Derek, isn't it? When we've had the decision on Talbot by Tata Steel and the future of the steelworks, which is obviously and rightly continuing to dominate headlines here with the loss of 2,800 jobs. It's a signal example of that lack of ability to plan ahead and for governments to work together constructively. What are your views, and what is the action, if any, that you can take to both to comment on it and to drive action now in terms of supporting those workers?
Yeah, really good question. I'm pleased we've come on to that, because that's the big economic issue of our time, isn't it? It's absolutely devastating for the communities of Port Talbot and around, with those job losses, but further job losses in the supply chain. And we need to learn the lessons, don't we? And we should have learned the lessons from the devastation that was caused to the coal mining communities when they were closed and nothing was done to support communities, or not done effectively to support those communities. It's incredibly frustrating to watch in some ways, isn't it? Because we could see this coming and we weren't prepared for it. We weren't doing the long-term planning and thinking that we needed to do to prepare for this kind of decision. And the Wellbeing of Future Generations Act encourages us to do that. Just as a sort of side point before I come back to Tata, one of the clear things that came through that the consultation work that I did and the involvement work that I did last year was we need to step up in terms of our support and capacity around foresight and futures work, so that we are using the information that Chris talks about, but then supporting public bodies to understand how they apply that to their policy and planning and programs that they're delivering on. And it came through very strongly. You see these sorts of units within big private sector firms where they've got this capacity and knowledge. And I think some parts of our public sector are good at this and others are not. And one of the commitments that I've made in our strategy is to do more to increase the capacity of the public sector in this regard. But just going back to Tata, you know, where do we go from here? I think, you know, it calls for far better, you know, longer term thinking, of course. You know, we've said that. It calls for the point we were making of better intergovernment governmental relationships. The fact that, you know, the Welsh government are saying they haven't been able to get meetings with some of the key ministers over the last few months is awful. You know, people expect their governments to be able to work together for their benefit. They're less interested, aren't they, about where the power lies, but they expect their governments to be working together. I don't know whether this is possible, but if you look at what the trade unions have been saying, there is an alternative to this decision that supports a transition to the electric arc furnace whilst keeping one of the blast furnaces open. Hopefully that can be kept on the table as a way of transitioning from where we are now to today. But what absolutely needs to happen is the people and the communities of Port Talbot and the people working in that area need to be supported into supporting a different new economy in that area for those jobs that will be lost. And that's where we've missed a trick. You know, we talk a lot about the green industries of the future and the green skills and jobs that we need for the future, but we're not really harnessing that, and we're not really taking advantage of that. Wales really could lead the way in creating the green jobs that we need in the energy sector, but also in the housing retrofit sector and in other sectors as well. And we're talking about it, but we're not seeing the delivery. So we've got to be serious about supporting these industries and supporting people with the skills to work in these industries. And we're seeing some levels of the investment committed, aren't we? Not just to Tata, but to the area. But they're probably nowhere near what's needed to support the community to the extent it deserves.
I don't think we know what's needed yet, do we? I mean, that's part. There's a chunk of money there, but we don't know if that's going to be enough or if it's going to be used to enable the kind of just transition that we want to see. I think your nod to people expecting governments to work together, absolutely, and that's a very clear message that came through from the Constitutional Commission's engagement work across the country. And at the IWRA, we've long said that Wales's priorities in terms of energy and the ability to create those new green jobs of the future that both support and enable different groups of people to build the Wales that they want to is in marine, bioenergy and homes. I want to come back to people and communities, and I've seen that Jane Davidson's put a link in the chat in terms of the Net Zero Challenge Group's work. I just want to talk about this very briefly, because as those of you who follow politics will know, the Wales Net Zero Challenge Group was created as part of the cooperation agreement between the Welsh Government and Plaid Cymru to explore those pathways towards achieving net zero by 2035, compatible with the ambitions and the goals and the ways of working of the Wellbeing of Future Generations Act. And it's got five key challenge groups around food and land use, energy, heating and buildings, mobility and connectivity, alongside the future of education and work. And they're working really to think holistically and identify those routes to net zero to deliver co-benefits that are compatible with that just transition and also nature positive. There is a further open call for evidence on a series of cross-cutting themes, in particular finance, just transition, nature and technology. So do please contribute if you have things to contribute to that. To that group. We at the IWRA are very much hoping to hold a citizens' assembly, because how things land and how we frame that communications around what needs to happen and how those changes need to be picked up by people and all of us in our everyday lives is really important. And we know from the experience that we've got before in terms of that detailed engagement with people, and particularly through the citizens panel that we did with the Open University 18 months ago, how well does the news help you understand politics, what's going on, that people move very, very clearly on a journey to greater action and involvement in issues when they've had clear and informed exposure to the facts about the issues that are under discussion. Chris, we've moved into question time now, so I'm not going to take up. I've got one tiny question at the end, and I'm really conscious. You know, we're three middle class people in this conversation. You have, you know, you're white men in professional roles. You occupy prominent roles focused on net zero and climate. What are you doing to encourage that diverse political leadership for tackling the crisis, or diverse leadership across the board? Because we've all got a role to make space for different voices to be heard, because the messenger really matters, because trust really matters in terms of who hears whom. How do you approach this in your roles? You've got about 30 seconds, Chris.
Well, it's a bigger, I'm not going to answer that in 30 seconds, except to say that this is probably the biggest challenge, I think, that we face when it comes to the representation of not just women, but a whole host of groups that aren't represented in the climate discussion. And it's thoroughly middle class and white. There's no doubt about it. And I think it's made doubly worse by the fact that the biggest topic is, of course, an energy topic. And you definitely have a male-dominated discussion there. I have this week been put on a MANL and refused to speak because I was on that MANL. These may sound tokenistic things, but I think it's important to do that. We have a diversity strategy for the CCC, which I'm extremely proud of. And one of the ways in which you're going to see that manifest itself in our advice is in the next piece of advice that we offer for the UK's carbon budget, and that we'll have within the next Welsh pathway as well. We're going to throw a lot at, in that next piece of work, looking properly at issues of diversity. And for me, the biggest challenge there is not really about representation of women in the energy discussion, as much as that is a big issue. It's that there are groups in society today who don't hear any of this, who will be deeply impacted by some of the things that we're talking about. We just had a discussion about Port Talbot. But think about, you know, where I live in Glasgow, there's a big Pakistani community of people living in houses in Glasgow whose houses are going to be decarbonized and aren't part of the discussion typically about how that should happen. So I think we need to be more thoughtful about how we reach out to those groups to get their view and to have them build into this. Now, it doesn't help that I'm a white middle class male leading this institution. So one of the most important things, I think, when I'm replaced is that we have a proper field of candidates, that every one of the people who's held this role so far has been a white middle-class male. So I'm rather hoping we might have a woman doing this job after this one. And we've also, you might notice, got a chairman's job going, and it is a chairman's job at the moment. That might be another way in which we can inject a bit of diversity, but it's hard. And one of the other challenges with a public body like this is that people come into a role and then typically do it for 5 to 10 years. So you really, in a transition that might last 25 years, that's actually a big chunk of it. So you've got to get this right from the off. And we haven't always been well supported by ministers who make the public appointments in these processes. We sort of handed excellent people, but nonetheless, they're not a diverse group.
Thank you, Chris. Derek?
Yeah, for the reasons Chris has given, this is fundamentally important. We know that certain groups will be impacted by climate change more than others, potentially in different areas, and we need their voices and their involvement to make sure that we support a just transition through these changes. And that will mean, you know, different approaches for different groups of people depending on their their exposure and the implications for them. You know, personally, this is very important to me. I inherited an approach that Chris just talked about from Sophie around not sitting on all male panels, and I take the same approach. We do a number of things. Involvement, Equal Wales is absolutely at the heart of the Wellbeing of Future Generations Act, as you'll know, Oriel. So it's, you know, we seek to walk the talk in everything we do. So during the consultation and involvement exercise, We did a lot to engage a wide range of different people, communities, groups in those conversations, and paid people for their time where appropriate, so that we weren't, exploiting the same people over and over again and asking them to contribute when they, you know, want to be earning a living elsewhere. So we also, and I think one of the great things that we do at the office is the Future Generations Leadership Academy, Oriel. So this is an academy for young people, and we support them to understand the Wellbeing of Future Generations Act and support them to be networked with others and to support them to get on in their careers. And we make a real effort to reach underrepresented groups and to create a really diverse group of people that come through this cohort. And we will be doing this on an annual basis from now on. Previously, it was perhaps every 2 years, so that we can support more young people from diverse backgrounds to get on in their careers in the Welsh public sector with a grounding and understanding of the Wellbeing of Future Generations Act. There's a number of other things that I can mention too, but it's
we're going to need to move to questions, and I'm going to come straight back to you, Derek, but we haven't got very long for questions and we've got lots of them. So question here from Karen Morrow. Thanks, Karen. One of the most encouraging things about seeking to address climate change in Wales is its inclusion in the Welsh Labour Plaid Cymru Cooperation Agreement, which lasts obviously till the end of this year, which counters to a degree the damaging tendency to treat it as a politically partisan issue, or worse, seeks to make it the next front in the culture wars. How do we make this an expected norm rather than exceptional? Derek. Oh,
wow, what an important question.
Thanks.
One of the ways I think we make it an accepted norm is by pointing to the facts here and taking the politics out of it. You know, we know, as Chris was saying, you know, we know what's happening, we know the impacts, and we can see the long-term trends. And if we keep coming back to the facts of the situation and what's needed to address them, I think that can help take some of the politics out of this. What I see in this role is broad political support for the Wellbeing of Future Generations Act, and actually, you know, the agenda that's set here for long-term thinking, which includes our agenda around climate change and carbon emissions, is one that has broad support. But we can't be complacent about that. So I think it comes down to, you know, making the case, keeping to the facts, showing progress, and, you know, I guess crucially, showing how this impacts on people. You know, this is about the impacts on people, but also making sure we improve the outcomes for people. So it's not a high level policy. It's not just a high level policy space. It's not just a conversation between policy wonks. It's not just something for, you know, environmentalists to be concerned about. This affects us all and is already affecting us all. The implications are closer than many people think. And so talking about, you know, what is happening, how it's affecting people, and engaging them in making change happen, I think is fundamental to, taking the politics out of it and bringing everyone along on this journey.
Thank you. Chris, you're in a reflective mode. Here you go. Going to put you on the spot. Great question from Steve Dimmick, who's commercial director at the Arran Cultural Trust. Looking back at your time at the UKCCC, what do you think is your most important achievement, and what do you hope the person stepping into your shoes will focus on?
Oh, I mean, I certainly have views on this. I mean, I'm very proud of the fact that when I started this job, it was a different organisation to the one it is now. I think and it's partly to do with what I've done here, but it's mainly to do with the fact that the issue's kind of risen up in status for people living in this country. So I came in to this job with the idea that there was already an amazingly good analytical organisation here, but it didn't have as loud a public voice as I felt it could have. And I definitely feel I'm leaving it now where, you know, people are much more willing to listen. So I think it's been brilliant for me to do that. It's also been kind of an amazing journey for me, because I am just I'm the policy one that Derek talked about. I used to be the guy in a cupboard somewhere, but I'm wheeled out now much more than I used to be. But that comes with a sort of darker edge to it, which is that I'm also the subject of a lot of attacks now as well, including mad stuff on the front pages of the Sunday Telegraph of last weekend. So it's quite an interesting experience to have that too. I think it's really important that whoever does this job does so with confidence, knowing that that's going to happen, but continues to do the pushing of the strong message. I think beyond that, the thing I'm most proud of definitely is the raising of ambition across the whole of the country. We advised that it was time to raise the ambition to net zero by 2050. It was also time to put in place proper plans to hit that. We've only gotten half the job on that, but I definitely feel that was important for the UK, for Wales, but also for other countries in the world. It created a sort of much more of a climate for other countries to do the same thing. And that is reflected now in what I think is now actual progress in the UN process. I'm not laying claim to that directly, but you've got much more enthusiasm to reach full decarbonisation and much more of a sense about how it could be done. So I think of my 6 years, that's definitely going to be the story I'll tell folk when I'm in my dotage. But I think, you know, that is not a job that's done, of course. So the next person's got to come in and pick up the baton on that.
I think your handover notes would be an interesting read. There's a great question here from Margot Greer. And Margot is saying, are there any sector-based intergovernmental committees working in the UK? She's got experience with those in Canada, operating in urban affairs, transport, housing, across federal, provincial, municipal lines without political party focus. And obviously, Margot, there is an intergovernmental review that is between the governments, but at a Westminster and devolved nations level. But I think what you're talking about here is across different levels and across party lines. And I wonder, Chris, if you have any experience of seeing that happening in a way that kind of gets the politics out of it and gets things done.
Yeah, this is a thing I have personally suggested on a number of occasions. I think this is a way to cut through some of that difficulty of, you know, devolved and reserved. That actually we have a set of sectoral challenges with common themes that require not just devolved and reserved discussions, but local government in there too, and probably even at a lower, even community groups. So I have seen this done well, but it tends to be when you've got a crisis. So I'm absolutely sure that there will be now some sort of group around the Port Talbot discussion, for example, that involves Welsh ministers, Welsh officials and UK officials, and probably people in that area and unions. And you can imagine, well, I at least think it would have been good if we could have done a lot of that sooner. So there's those sorts of things do tend to happen, but they're usually reactive. The one time when I think we did more proactive work on this, and I was in government at the time, it was actually around some of the early Brexit discussions. There was more of an ability to get around the table. And again, it was because there was an acknowledgement that there was a mixture of devolved and reserved issues going on. But again, even that was a reaction. You mentioned earlier, Oriel, this is going to be a year of political change of some kind. I would love to see whatever flavour of government we have at the end of this calendar year, I would love to see some more thought put into how we operate government across the country to allow those sorts of discussions to take place in a more progressive and positive way. And I think going at it through the sectors is probably quite a good way of looking at it. And it's not just a climate issue. I think you could have a far better discussion if you were clear about what direction you were trying to take the British transport system and what implication that had for Wales. Because you, in the end, you need to have a joined up a process to make that work well, and we don't have it at the moment.
No, and there's a really good challenge there for you, Derek, isn't there, in terms of how you could help facilitate and create and hold, you know, some space for that.
Yeah, I know, absolutely. I think, you know, we keep coming back to this, don't we? It's interesting how we keep coming back to this issue of governments working together, and also, you know, the report of the Constitutional Commission, which, you know, addressed this very clearly. And I think one of the things that there's so much relevance in that report, Oriel, and I'm not yet clear on what's going to be done as a result of the recommendations in that report. There's a lot around involvement. There's a lot around these arrangements. And I think, you know, at the very least, one of the things that I can do in this role is make sure we maintain attention on the report and that's recommendations. And as we see new leadership within the Welsh Government, seek to get clear commitments on where we go next so that report is actioned as a result of the hard work over the last couple of years.
We'll be, at the IWA, we'll be looking at the report in more detail, unpicking the evidence. And Chris, you talked before about, you know, there's very little that happened that is just one or the other in terms of, you know, reserved or default. Our colleague Akash Pound on the expert panel from the Institute for Government did a brilliant setting out of the money that is spent in each area and the differences as well, and just sort of unpicking some of that. So a lot of the evidence that's been submitted to the Commission, which we've pushed to be publicly available from a repository, I think Welsh Government is in the process of setting that up, so that people can make their own minds up and delve into that evidence and not just look at the conclusions of the Commission. There's a question here from our friend Huel Lloyd. Thanks, Huel. Previous energy transitions have seen, and he put transitions in inverted commas, have seen a lot of value extracted from Wales. We talked about coal, obviously, but before. And some suggest that a lowest cost transition could continue wealth inequality. What can Wales do more of to retain wealth that will come from the net zero transition? And Chris, that's probably for you first, I think.
Yeah, it is, and it also isn't. I mean, it's quite interesting. I mean, my role is to sort of open the option space for how we decarbonize and adapt to climate change. And specifically, it's not about the politics of that transition, but I think here we might stray into some of the politics of it. It's my own view that there's, you know, 100 ways to decarbonize an economy, but that challenge isn't really the big thing anymore. The sort of technical challenge of how you do it isn't the biggest challenge of all. It's how to do it equitably. Mm-hmm. And the kind of two aspects of it that I think are important is one is the sort of distributional cost, which is often the way that we look at it. You know, how do you spread the costs and the benefits of this in the sort of fiscal sense? That's clearly a big thing. But the other bit, and this is very firmly outside of my remit, is where does the economic value of this return to? And that just does not get enough attention, I think. Interestingly, it does in other places. So the whole kind of movement in the US under Biden to have an Inflation Reduction Act, for example, and you might find it odd that I'm going to the US at this stage to talk about that, but that is born of this idea that, yes, we have to decarbonize, but it should be through having some sort of domestic production base for some of the things that will drive that decarbonization. And they've very much, because it's the US, they're able to do that, you know, with a big bazooka gun to make that happen. But I think some of that thinking we could do with having back here, and this isn't me saying we need an industrial strategy. I think it's more about where's the creative thought about that. One of the really interesting aspects of the transition as it's being envisaged now with that technical work is that we will not be importing lots of things from other parts of the world when it comes to fossil fuels by the time we hit the sort of mid-century. We will naturally be returning what we call GDP multipliers. You'd be bringing stuff back into the country that presently is produced somewhere else. I think we could make more of that. I mean, these energy systems that I keep referring to will be more localized. And it's a sort of feature of them, actually. And it's not designed to be a local energy system. But I think we will be talking about, as we once did, for example, municipal energy systems again. So in towns and villages and cities in Wales, almost certainly we will have to be thinking about how we decarbonize them at that sort of level. It happens to be that's where most of the trust still lies in public bodies as well. So, I mean, where I am in Glasgow, it's almost certainly going to have to be some sort of Glasgow-wide plan. And if you put Glasgow on that, people are more willing to support it. So I tend to think, like, if you start from that sort of basis, it's not just about geography here, but, you know, that thinking about that through a different lens, we have the technical solutions. We could think about, you know, returning more of the social value, more of the economic value to locales as we do this, whilst doing all this technical stuff that, of course, we know we have to do and every other country in the world will have to do as well. It's one of the real fascinating features of this. The reason why I want to stay working in climate is the future is actually pretty well mapped out. It's how you get there that's the challenge rather than what you're getting to. And I think that's really interesting when it comes to that question.
That's really helpful. Thank you.
Can I jump in on that, Ariel, just very quickly? I mean, this sort of draws on a bit of my background in the co-op sector, really. And I think I'm saying the same, but ownership, I think, is so important in this space. We are seeing a transition, aren't we? And we want to see that happen quickly. But if the ownership of those resources are then owned elsewhere, we see the profit extracted. And I've been a little bit frustrated by the progress that we should have been making in terms of community energy in Wales and cooperative energy schemes. We've got some of the biggest schemes. I think Egni and Awilam and Towie cooperative energy schemes are some of the biggest in the UK. So we've got some success stories to point to, but boy, did they have a problem getting off the ground. And it wasn't just about funding, it was about policy and it was about planning. So we need to enable more of this to happen. In this space, in England, for example, they have a booster scheme so that when communities raise community shares to fund community energy schemes, and you do see significant amounts of money being raised in these sorts of schemes, it's matched by a booster scheme, which is, I think, come from the lottery in England. We don't have that in Wales, and that would give the community energy sector a real boost in terms of its finance. So I think we need to find ways in which when we're investing publicly, but also when we're supporting this transition, that the ownership is retained to some extent, even in the public sector, on the community sector, on the employee-owned sector, so that the profits being made and stay within Wales and stay within the communities that need it. And also, you know, what this means, as Chris was saying, is you're more likely to get community support for some of the controversial, you know, sort of energy schemes and, you know, building in rural areas, if the community is involved in that and they have a stake and they benefit not just from the energy, but from the surpluses made by these schemes. So I think we need to do a lot more in this space. And I think, you know, this is certainly an area I'm going to be given more attention in this role.
I'm glad to hear that, Derek. It's something that certainly since Re-energising Wales, we've been very hot on. And the work that we've done on community ownership and assets as well, because we're behind in terms of the legislation in Wales, in terms of communities having the chance to own assets that could be generative from that perspective, in comparison to other bits of the UK. And our forthcoming report by my colleague Lydia Godden will be looking at community benefits programmes, where they're working well and where they're not working well, and what good practice is in this regard. So watch out for that next month. And I see we've got lots of questions and we've got about 7 minutes left. We are going to finish on time. There's a good question here from Grant Paisley from DEG, who's talked about how they've engaged nearly 900 people in 5 areas of Gwynedd on community climate action via inclusive community climate assemblies and an education programme in schools. And one of the things the Constitutional Commission has obviously talked about a lot is civic education, which would include this kind of thing. And if this approach, he says, was repeated throughout Wales, we'd have nearly 20,000 citizens engaged in the transition to net zero, co-creating actions for local people to lead. How, you know, I think his question, I think, is going to be in I'm going to answer part of it myself, because I think we do agree that these type of community-led approaches can play a key part in supporting engagement, behaviour change and buy-in. But there's a question here, and it's really about who should be responsible for organising and funding this work in Wales. And Derek, that one's for you. Who's responsible for organising and funding it?
Oh, God, we're all responsible for that, aren't we? I know Grant, and I know that some of that work, and it's fantastic and really impressive. And what we need to see is when we see great initiatives like this, and we say it in perhaps every meeting I go to, you know, we need to see that happen all across Wales and not just in certain parts of it. If we can understand how it can work well, why aren't we delivering right across that Wales? So right across Wales. So I think there's something in there about expectation that me and others can provide. You know, this is what we expect to see. It's certainly part of the Wellbeing of Future Generations Act that, you know, public bodies should be working with community groups and involving people. So I think, you know, the legislation means it's on all of us. This is not a Welsh Government fund. It's not a lottery fund. This is part of the ways of working. This is the DNA of the Wellbeing of Future Generations Act. And it's incumbent on all of us to take this approach to, you know, policy in this area or in others. And, you know, what's so impressive is when you do see communities taking this approach, or you see public bodies taking this approach, you often, it might take more time, sometimes it might be a little bit more expensive, but you usually go further and you go faster in terms of the impact and the outcomes that you see from these schemes. So it's, you know, people will be creative about the solutions, they will be bought into what needs to happen, they will be stimulated to take their own actions. And, you know, you can see incredible progress if we get this right. So I think we do see some of this good practice right across Wales. But of course, you know, as always, we need to see it more widespread and in every part of Wales.
Thank you. And Ori, just to add to that, I mean, I've participated in probably around 10 climate assemblies now in the time I've done this job. And some have been fantastic. Some have been only good, but they've all been good. But the key thing, I think I take a lot of learning from that. They're amazing processes. These participative processes are fantastic in all sorts of ways. But you have to follow through on it. And in particular, the UK one. I mean, I took part in the UK Climate Assembly. It was an incredibly well-funded thing that the Select Committees and the House of Commons funded. It was a brilliant exercise. And then we saw a process after that of sort of almost dismissing its findings. And of course, that's doubly damaging if you've taken part in that process and then you see that the findings aren't followed through. So, I mean, that's the key thing for me, is that there's something wonderful in this, but it's also incredibly destructive if you don't follow it through.
It's much harder to do it well than I think people think it is, actually, is certainly our experience of doing it. And we've had fantastic partners doing that kind of thing with. Very, very briefly, Chris, this is for you. This is from Jen Baxter, who's a commissioner on the National Infrastructure Commission for Wales, with a really good challenge around moving away from false narratives and communicate more effectively. So hearing some falsehoods today about if we don't invest in roads, it's better for net zero, and we get active travel, and that closing the blast furnaces at Port Talbot has anything to do with net zero. Makes good headlines, but the need for new fuels, materials, construction processes, and alternative solutions to manufacturing and waste management alongside biodiversity are the areas we need to hear more about. How can we make that happen and cut through better? Chris, very quickly, please.
It will be quick. I mean, we've got to keep this positive. So there are indeed lots of false narratives. It's absolutely poisonous, some of the stuff you see. One of the things in my job is you really do see the wiring of the kind of British state, and there's a set of genuinely bad faith actors out there whose job it is to fuel these stories, and they do extremely well. I have a sort of begrudging admiration for the way in which they do it, actually. It's quite impressive. But it's hard to combat, but the way we combat it is by not using strap lines, not slapping net zero and everything and imagining that's just enough to do to wash it in green stuff, but actually to have detailed view of what that future looks like and, crucially, sell the benefits of it. It's a positive vision of the future. I think the last thing I'll say in this is I've got one minute left. It's often portrayed, this net zero stuff, as some sort of radical transition. It's not radical. It's just where we will need to be. And actually the world in the future will look very similar to the world that we have now. And I think that it's that radical framing that puts people off. Actually, this is a thing that will be happening. It just happens to also help the climate. So I think you might odd to hear me say this, but I'd be very happy to see the climate stuff come second. We do this because we care about jobs and it helps the climate. We're making people warmer in their homes and it helps the climate. That for me is how you combat this.
Great, that's really helpful. Thank you very much indeed, both of you. Thank you for joining us today and for sharing your thoughts, and to everybody else who's been with us today and contributed to the discussion. We've had some really great questions, and I'm sorry we didn't get to them all. And I know there's been some really good stuff in the chat, and we'll be following up with bits and pieces in the and sharing that as well. Our aim, obviously, in these open and free events is always to identify issues that need further thought, articulate really clearly what those issues are, and get people thinking about what needs to change, why, how, what their own roles are, so that we can all play our own part in inspiring Wales's ambition. And if you want to receive early notifications of future IWA events and recordings of all our sessions directly in your inbox without even having to go and look for them, please do join us as a member on the supporters page of our website at iwa.wales. Derek, you wanted to come in.
I think before you go, I just wanted to say, pay credit to you both. I think, Oriel, this might be one of your last meetings in the role at IWA. And I know Chris has a few months left, but your presence in this space, I know, won't be lost because you're moving into related roles, but you've both played such an important role in this area as independent, challenging and constructive voices, which has led and is leading to the kind of changes that we want to see. So we will miss you a huge amount in these roles. And I wanted to personally wish you luck in your next endeavours. So
Very kind of you.
Thank you, Derek. Very kind of you too. And good luck, Oriel.
And you too. We'll be watching. Jochen Varian, thanks very much, everybody. Bye-bye.